Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how high might Arizona gas prices get and when might they come down? And we'll meet an ASU doctoral student who is a contestant on season two of Beast Games. But first, the State House of Representatives later today is scheduled to vote on a measure that would create two new crimes, civil terrorism and subversion. The bill's sponsor says it's aimed at protesters who are critical of ICE, but some of his colleagues say it may have unintended consequences. With me now, as he is every Monday during the legislative session, to talk about what to expect this week at the state capitol, is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning, but I'm out filling up gas cans because Lord knows what's going to happen.
Seriously, not a bad idea. So tell me about this bill. It's coming up for a roll call vote in the House today, and it sounds as though it's gone through some changes in the recent past.
Yeah, this was crafted by the Manhattan Institute. They're a fairly conservative organization. In fact, one of their founders later went on to become the CIA director. The idea is to close some, what people believe are some loopholes in terms of people stirring things up, trying to subvert the government. So it had some fairly broad language in there. For example, advocate to try to influence the behavior of civilian population or stir up, fear and such. And the problem with that, according to Representative Alexander Culloden, is, wait a second, what stirs up fear? He said, for example, he had put out a bill that said, look, we may not have Colorado River water. Maybe you need to figure out what's going on, and maybe the water companies and the cities and such need to tell people what happens if there's no water. Mm. Could I have been guilty of civil terrorism? Then you've got the whole issue of trying to subvert the government. And his point is, well, wait a second. Again, as conservatives, it's our job to keep the government from just growing like Topsy. And so if we're trying to get rid of certain elements of the government, are we trying to subvert the government? So the bill that finally got out of what they call Committee of the Whole debate calendar last week is watered down somewhat. It's scheduled for a floor vote today, but there's still a lot of folks who think it goes too far. I'm sure there are a lot of folks who think it doesn't go far enough.
Does it seem like this might be a party line vote coming up later today?
I'm guessing it will be. Democrats as a whole are very concerned about things that they believe will entrap people who are just doing, legitimate protest. You know, if you are out there and you're blocking traffic, for example, are you trying to subvert society? Are you trying to scare people into doing something? And it's the concern that when you legislate this way and you've got fairly broad terms, what gets swept in with that?
Right. Howie, another bill that's gotten a lot of attention and has also been diluted somewhat is the proposal dealing with marijuana smoke in residential neighborhoods. You'd written about how the sponsor, Senator J.D. Mesnard, sounds like he was just kind of tired of smelling people smoking pot in his backyard. What are some of the changes that have been made to that bill that's coming up for a roll call vote in the Senate?
Well, as originally crafted, essentially, if I'm sitting in my backyard, I smell marijuana from my neighbor or however far away it is, a crime's been committed. Well, okay, what else should be a crime? I mean, I don't happen to like my neighbor's use of lighter fluid or something like that, or his tobacco smoke or his pipe smoke or anything like that. And it became a kind of situation where a lot of folks said, what exactly becomes a nuisance? So he's trying to redefine what is, quote unquote, excessive marijuana smoke. So it's A, detectable by a reasonable person of ordinary sensibilities, occurs for more than 30 consecutive minutes on a single occasion. If it crosses the boundary line and unreasonably interferes with the use and enjoyment of a nearby property, that becomes considered a nuisance. They've also taken out the criminal penalties. There obviously are concerns, since we've legalized marijuana both for medical use in 2006 and for 2010, 2020, we did it for recreational use. There's a lot more people smoking. Now, remember, you cannot smoke in public. In other words, you can't go out to just outside the Capitol and light up a doobie. but you can smoke in your backyard. Question becomes, at what point your ability to smoke or whatever you're doing that's causing odor causes such concern for the neighbors that they can't reasonably enjoy their yards?
I mean, it kind of raises the question, and you'd reported earlier that the bill specifically excluded, for, as you referenced, cigarette smoke, pipe smoke. So, like, is it, I mean, were there questions raised about whether this is constitutional or not to criminalize what is an otherwise legal behavior?
Well, that's going to be certainly a question. I think that the attorneys who have looked at this have said, you can't single out one particular thing as being offensive to you. Is marijuana smoke any more offensive than tobacco smoke? Now, obviously, if it's so intense, we don't want the 4-year-old getting a contact high from what the neighbors are doing. But by the same token, is it any more offensive than, you know, again, charcoal lighter fluid or, you know, somebody working on their car and the diesel fumes coming over the fence?
Yeah.
And that becomes a really tricky problem where courts will say you can't decide unilaterally that this is offensive and this is not.
Right. All right. Lots more on the calendar. Unfortunately, we are out of time with Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always. Appreciate it.
Have a great day.
Anyone who's filled up their gas tanks lately or even just driven by a gas station has seen gas prices are on the rise in Arizona. AAA Arizona says on average, a gallon of regular unleaded gas costs about $3.86 today. That's up almost 80 cents from last month and up more than 50 cents since just last week. The average price in Maricopa County is above $4 a gallon today. With me now to explain why is Doug Johnson with AAA Mountain West Group. Doug, good morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So there's been a lot of talk about the impact of the war with Iran and, you know, sort of its impact on the oil supply. Is that most of what's going on? Is that all that's going on? Is it just a part of what's going on here?
It's pretty much a lot of what's going on. There's also the switch that we see seasonally to go from winter blend gasoline over to summer blend gasoline. Now, the winter blend gasoline is cheaper to produce, so it costs you less at the pump, but there's more additives in the summer blend. So it's more expensive, and that is happening right now. Really bad timing. There's also several refineries that are shutting down in California. Phillips Carson 66 shut down late last year, and I think it was switching over to jet fuel. And then up in the Bay Area, we have Valero Benicia shutting down in April. So just bad timing all around for the West Coast.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, you referenced the summer blend, and it's not unusual for, you know, Arizona drivers, Phoenix drivers especially, to see gas prices go up a little bit this time of year. But it seems pretty atypical for them to go up, you know, for example, 50 cents a week.
Yeah, no, this is pretty much something we only see during conflicts in the Middle East. And again, what's going on is, of course, the U.S. doesn't get its oil from Iran. But China and India do. So when they're not getting their oil from Iran, they're going to have to go to the same sources that we do to get our oil. And then, of course, everything that's going on with the Strait of Hormuz, a lot of those Persian Gulf countries that we do get our oil from, not be able to send it out. It's really causing a backup of oil supply that's just not reaching the United States.
I'm not sure if fragile is the right word here, but I will use it. How fragile is the supply chain here? Like, given that there are some tankers that are sort of backed up in the Strait of Hormuz, like, how much of a downstream impact does that have on us here in the valley?
Oh, I mean, you're seeing it, the price at the pump in Arizona in the last week, we've gone up 53 cents. And Arizona is actually ranking among the top states for recent weekly price increases. It's in the top five alongside other states like Indiana and Ohio. So it's pretty fragile. You know, any sort of conflict in the Middle East, it does have an impact. The last time we saw the increase go up this much in a week, I think it went up about 11 cents back in 2022 overnight. And that is, of course, when Russia invaded Ukraine. So it's not unheard of. We've seen similar jumps happening when, Operation Desert Storm took place in the early 90s. But, you know, this is a pretty big jump that we haven't seen in a long time.
Well, you mentioned sort of the perfect storm of events causing it. We're also, of course, into the time of spring break when a lot of people tend to drive out of town to go on vacation for a period of time. What are you seeing in terms of how this might be affecting people's travel choices?
Absolutely. It's supply and demand. And of course, demand goes up when the weather gets nicer. All the kids are off school for spring break. So some people, you know, we are hearing some folks are canceling. Some folks are just looking to stay closer to home, sort of staycation rather than driving all the way across state lines or, you know, taking international trips. But, you know, we do have some advice for our AAA members. If you are trying to save gas, you know, plan your trip, make things more fuel efficient by planning your routes out. You know, if you're going to the grocery store and then the pharmacy and then somewhere else back to school, make sure you're doing that in one trip and that you're tracking the shortest distance to do it. Another thing we do tell our members is to avoid speeding. You know, fuel economy peaks at around 50 miles per hour on most cars, and then it drops off as speed increases. So driving the recommended speed limit can actually increase your fuel economy between 7 and 14%. This goes without saying, but, you know, avoid idling. Avoid just sitting in your car having your air conditioning running. You know, it may be sort of warm in Arizona, but you could probably just roll down the window. Try and wait in the coffee shop or where you're going. Don't wait in your car. And another big thing I think people don't realize is you got to check your tire pressure, especially as we're getting to hotter weather. You know, when you have improper tire pressure, it reduces your tires. It has more friction with your tire if it's lower to the ground. So you can fill up your tires and get less friction, and it's easier then to move your car and you use less gas to drive around.
Yeah. Understanding that crystal balls are often cloudy, especially when it comes to this. Do you have any kind of indication as to either how, well, let's start with how high prices might get in the Phoenix area?
You know, we really don't have a crystal ball. We try not to make predictions. In fact, right before this conflict started, we were reporting that gas prices were lower this time this year than they were at this time last year. So we really just, at AAA, we don't try and predict the future.
Is it safe to say, though, that the longer that this conflict in the Middle East goes on, the less chance of prices coming down precipitously will happen?
Absolutely. I mean, it's all about supply. If we're not getting the same amount of supply and the demand keeps going up, it will definitely cause prices to increase. And especially going on with what's going on with the Strait of Hormuz. You know, if they don't get that oil moving in time, I know there's some alternative routes they're looking into, but if it's slowed down there, it will cause prices to go up.
Yeah, interesting. All right. That is Doug Johnson with AAA Mountain West Group. Doug, thanks for your insights. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what it's like to be a contestant on the controversial reality show Beast Games. But first, exports from Arizona businesses to other countries increased 37% last year, more than $44 billion worth. That's among the findings of a new report from the Arizona Commerce Authority. The data also show that Taiwan has overtaken Canada and China to become the state's second biggest trading partner after Mexico. Sandra Watson is president and CEO of the Arizona Commerce Authority. She stopped by the studio to talk about the new numbers, but I asked how significant are some of the changes she's seeing.
The new trade numbers are so significant for Arizona. It really demonstrates that Arizona has really become a global powerhouse. We're seeing significant increases in exports as well as imports. Our trade numbers have exponentially grown year over year. We've seen a 37% increase just in the last year for exports. That's really driven by a lot of our advanced manufacturing projects that we've landed over the last 5 years. So a tremendous opportunity for Arizona.
One of the things that stood out to me was that in terms of the countries with whom Arizona does business, Taiwan is now number two behind Mexico. How much of that is TSMC and how much of it might be other things unrelated to that?
Yeah. So a significant portion of that is going to be TSMC. With their $165 billion investment in Arizona, we're seeing a lot of imports for computer equipment and electronics. Components coming in, but we're also seeing a tremendous amount of exports back to Taiwan. So having a massive project like TSMC, as I mentioned, $165 billion investment, that includes six new fabs, two advanced packaging facilities, and an R&D center. So as we continue to see the ramp up of those production facilities, we're going to continue to see our exports grow substantially, as well as our imports.
Can you foresee a time when Taiwan would overtake Mexico to become Arizona's biggest trading partner?
Well, I do think that the rapid growth that we're seeing in Taiwan, that we could potentially see that kind of growth. What's interesting about Taiwan is not only do we have a significant investment from TSMC, but we've seen over a dozen new companies from Taiwan land in Arizona. And we've got over, 30, 40 new projects that we're working with companies in Taiwan. So we're going to continue to see this rapid growth from Taiwan, but not just Taiwan. I mean, we're seeing a tremendous amount of activity from Japan as well. And also foreign direct investment from Canada. So if you think about the foreign direct investment that we're seeing in our state, just over the last year, we've won 55 new international expansion projects. That has represented over $107 billion worth of investment and potentially 25,000 new jobs. Over the last 5 years, those numbers from a foreign direct investment standpoint have been 250 new international projects in the state of Arizona. That represents about $195 billion and close to 55,000 new jobs. So as we start to think about Arizona's international footprint, it's growing across all countries that we have. We've got several foreign offices. So Taiwan continues to grow at an exponential rate, but we're also seeing tremendous opportunities in Japan, South Korea, Europe, Canada, Mexico. So overall, I think what we've done is we've diversified our international footprint, which is great news for Arizona because we'll continue to see all of those markets grow.
I want to ask you about Canada, which you mentioned a couple times, which for the longest time had been the second biggest trading partner behind Mexico. It's moved down a little bit. And we've seen, some reporting that Canadians, for example, aren't coming here as much given the current political situation and to some extent the economic situations. Is that at play here, or are there other factors that maybe led Canada to slide down the list a little bit?
No, I think that truly we saw exponential growth in Taiwan. So they overtook that position because of the amount of activity. We're still seeing a tremendous amount of activity in Canada. Foreign direct investment there, they represent the second highest country for foreign direct investment in Arizona, along with obviously Japan and Taiwan. So we're seeing a tremendous amount of activity from Canada as well. There are strong trading partners, so I think we'll continue to see a very robust relationship with Canada.
Obviously, when it comes to Taiwan, the semiconductor industry is a really big component, I would imagine, of a lot of that foreign direct investment, some of the imports and exports. Are there other industries that either to Taiwan and or other countries that are particularly strong here?
Absolutely. So we're seeing, as you mentioned, semiconductor industry, along with electronics components, continue to be very, very, very strong opportunity for Arizona. But we're also seeing tremendous opportunities in aerospace products and parts, along with high-tech industries. And that is happening across the globe. And Arizona truly has become North America's semiconductor headquarters. And with that now brings a number of other industries, suppliers to the semiconductor industry. But that also creates opportunities in a lot of other industries like bioscience. And there's a lot of med tech devices that we're focused on. So when we're in Taiwan, not only are we talking to companies in the semiconductor industry, we're also having conversations with companies in other industries.
Do you find that sort of clustering is happening intentionally, that because a company, for example, like TSMC is investing so much in Arizona that other companies in Taiwan, and this probably would apply to other countries as well, say, oh, it seems to be going well, we should go there too?
Absolutely. I think what it demonstrated over the last 5 years is that Arizona is a top market for global companies and other companies within Taiwan and other markets there. We're seeing a lot of activity in South Korea and Japan as well. That, this has signaled to them that Arizona's got a great business environment and great high quality workforce and an opportunity for businesses to expand into the U.S. Arizona becomes a great landing spot for them. TSMC has really, I think, signaled to the world how competitive Arizona really is compared to other states. And we're seeing a tremendous amount of activity as a result of that.
What does all this mean for the average Arizonan? Like, why should people who live here care about foreign direct investment and where we are exporting things and from where we are importing things?
Absolutely. I mean, export-based industries really provide additional wealth to the state. So it comes in the form of jobs, so new job creation, higher quality jobs, as well as investment. And because of that investment, tax revenue is generated. So Arizonans are feeling that not only in the ability to access a great job market, but also in the revenue that is generated from these projects. So all the way around, exports-based industries provide added wealth to our state's economy, which ultimately filters through the entire economy. As you're seeing with a number of these significant investments, a number of local serving businesses are benefiting. So you're seeing more restaurants, you're seeing more service companies, and it's really providing a lot of economic momentum for the entire state.
All right. That is Sandra Watson, President and CEO of the Arizona Commerce Authority. Sandra, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Mark. I appreciate it.
Med students at the University of Arizona have lots of mandatory courses to complete. Many of them are similar to what you'd find at other medical schools, but one of them is a bit unique, improv. Over the course of four intensive three-hour sessions, aspiring doctors gather with instructors to perform theater games, free associate, and just generally play. For a cohort of students that tends to be fairly serious and practical in their thinking, it's not always comfortable. But as instructor Jackie Aaron tells my co-host Sam Dingman, it's extremely important to their development. Aaron conceived the program with U of A faculty member Dr. Howard Silverman based on what he saw as a mental health crisis.
He had been really sort of processing and thinking about the burnout rate of doctors and especially the suicide rate. Because doctors are not given skill sets to cope. They're sort of just given this idea that they have to sort of repress or put this cold layer over their emotions so that they're not as affected. But that result is that they then don't know how to process any of it and it becomes too big and it's very sad. And he's like, how do we fix this? Like, how do we fix this problem? And he was like, improv could be the key. Improv could easily be the key because what we're doing is we're asking folks to play and we're asking folks to be imaginative and to really practice their critical thinking and their creative problem-solving skills to create positive communication skills that allow for deeper connections, self-awareness and the ability to self-evaluate and check in.
So tell me a little bit about what it was like for you getting in a room with med students for the first time.
We walked into that space the first day and had hoped they would buy in.
Right.
But I think the hard thing, especially in a high-stakes environment like the first year of med school.
Oh, boy.
We know that an implied improv space is when you walk into a business and you try and you introduce improvisation to business-minded folks, you are certainly going to get right and wrong answer paralysis. But they have even more rigidity in there just because they have to know the right and wrong answers.
Yeah, right? Because the stakes in business are not necessarily life or death or wellness or unwellness. Like,
right.
And if you're a first-year med student, you know, coming in with that as your kind of benchmark, I would think.
Right, for sure. And sort of what we were trying to say to them all at that time is like, we're introducing this at the same time that you're going through that because we think it's important that you're exercising this muscle simultaneously so that you're not getting too rigid and then we're having to sort of, you know, unpack all of it later. Like, you can come in with this plasticity, right? So there were lots of groups that sort of went on and had a lot of challenge just because they didn't feel safe.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of that was our learning curve of like, OK, well, we're going to have to like really come at them with their language, with what they're wanting out of this. We have to unlock the doors that they're wanting to open right now.
So can you give me an example of what an early exercise with a med student looks like as you're beginning to work with them in one of these first sessions?
Yeah, like on that first day, and this is similar to all applied improv experiences, you know, you were sort of just trying to acknowledge the nerves. you know, you really have to be very clear that this is about repping and about strengthening and not about being funny. Mm-hmm. Like you really have to take that aspect of this being comedy out of the way.
Uh-huh.
And so you're saying that's not what this is about. It's not about showing up and being funny. It's just about showing up.
Right.
It's just about showing up and listening well and responding honestly with how the moment is impacting you. And so then you get them up on their feet and you do really simple like word association exercises or just name game of moving their body and matching energies. It's very important, too, in this first part that you really have the conversation about mistakes and about that they don't exist in improv, that we have guidelines to make strong choices over choices that aren't going to maybe get us as far or get us as connected. And those are the things that we're strengthening is stronger skills. But ultimately, there's no wrong answer. So you're getting people comfortable with just making a choice and getting through the fear.
Like move your body in this way.
Right.
And then your partner is like, what does that make you – how does that make you want to move your body?
Yeah,
like,
or just make a sound and I'll match that sound, you know. And so it's like immediate choice making and affirmation of the choice, right? Because you're saying, yes, I love that choice, so I'm going to match it. And I'm going to push it this much further, right?
Right. I'll make the sound louder or – yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, they do word association, which is just like, yeah, getting them out of the habit of thinking about the choices before choosing them. Like the word association stuff is, okay, well, I hear mall. Mall makes me think girls. So now we've created the idea of mall girls, right?
Right.
Mall by itself is its one own thing.
Right.
Girls by itself is one thing. Mall girls is like a group of teenage girls who hang out in the food court.
Right. So, you know, when you get to the end of like the fourth session, what have you seen transform in the students? Do you find that, I mean, at this point, are they like improvising full shows or do you find that their comfort level evolves?
I think so. I think that it's tough because each time we sort of have to go through the process of reminding them, remember, this was fun. What we were experiencing was, okay, first session, we're going to be excited if we can just get them at least all to agree on the same emotion and physicalize it for 5 seconds. by the second week, we're going to just be happy if they can just find some joy in a lot of the discomfort of the exercises. By week three, we just want them to be feeling confident. And we have like on the fourth session, we sort of do it more as a celebratory, like, hey, you came this far. Let's get you on your feet playing and sort of thinking about would you have ever imagined that you could do that and create in this way and collaborate in this way and connect in this way, you know, when we first started. And now we can all take just a bigger breath around how heavy this thing is.
And it's okay, it seems like, you know, to like come together and experience this. Maybe it's you're laughing at it. Maybe you're just kind of marveling at it. But it's maybe not something you have to go back to the origin story of the program. It doesn't have to be a crisis.
Yeah, right. For sure. A lot of things that we're talking about with the medical doctors is like you're going to have pieces of information, but you're not going to have the whole puzzle, right? You have to decide what roads am I going to take to fill in the puzzle. And that's what improv is. You've got one piece of information at the start. Oh, my scene partner's happy. My second piece of information is, oh, I'm feeling a little nervous. If they're happy and I'm nervous, we're cliff diving. It's my first time and they're telling me it's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
And so we're telling them that the skill set of taking an A and a very divergent M in the alphabet and finding the middle.
Right. B through L.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Well, I have been speaking with Jackie Arendt, who is lead facilitator and instructor of the medical improv program at the University of Arizona. Jackie, thank you for this conversation.
You're welcome.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Let's turn the clock back now to 2022. Election denialism was everywhere, and the Cochise County Board of Supervisors made national headlines for refusing to certify the results of the election there. They had to be ordered by a judge to do it, and some of them faced criminal prosecution as a result of their delay. Well, now they're raising the same election concerns they raised then and asking the federal government to investigate. The board sent a letter to Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard asking her to investigate the laboratories that test voting machines and find out if they were properly accredited before recent elections. They also sent an identical letter to U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi a few months earlier. It's all raising questions about the upcoming 2026 elections and if we can expect them to refuse to certify the results again. Sasha Hupka is covering it for VoteBeat, and she spoke more about it with my co-host Lauren Gilger.
Back in 2022, two of the three Cochise County supervisors at the time tried to delay certification of that county's general election results past the legal deadline. And ultimately, they were ordered by a judge that they had to certify that vote. But back then, they listed a few reasons why they were hesitant to proceed with that certification. And part of their reasoning was this disputed claim that laboratories charged with testing these voting machines nationally weren't properly accredited. And now this is coming back and it seems like they still have their doubts.
Okay. So, yes, a few years later, they definitely still have their doubts. And now they're asking Tulsi Gabbard and basically the federal government to investigate claims to try to verify that. What are they after here?
Well, so first, I think it's just worth noting, like, this is the second request on this that they've made to the feds in basically less than 6 months.
Yeah.
And it's really not even just that. They've also repeatedly suggested over the last year that they're going to continue to challenge election laws and election processes. For instance, when they were appointing a new county recorder last year, one supervisor said they wanted someone who'd be willing to fight with Chris Mays.
Wow.
And so I don't know that supervisors are planning an exact redo of 2022. After I published this story, I actually got a chance to talk with Frank Antonori, who is the board chair, and he told me that the board is committed to following the law in 2026. But he also made clear they want to get election laws and processes into the courts because they feel that these have all been tweaked in a partisan way in recent years. And I think to me, what all of this suggests, the big takeaway here, is that they're going to continue to question the legal basis of state and even federal election laws in 2026.
Tell us about these claims they're making, which have been disputed about voting machine testing and like the accreditation of the places that do the testing. Is there any proof, any proof in the pudding there that there are issues there?
So these labs, they're accredited by the EAC, the Election Assistance Commission, to do this type of testing. And they do them on the vote counting machines, the tabulators. All of these voting systems have to go through this testing before any, you know, counties are able to purchase them and use them in an actual election. And the EAC has said, you know, look, these claims, they're baseless. They stem from during COVID. The voting systems were supposed to be reaccredited every 2 years during COVID. They said, you know, look, we're not going to continue doing that. If it already was accredited, it's grandfathered in and, you know, can continue to just be accredited. So that's the basis on which Cochise County is challenging this. But the EAC has repeatedly said that this is not the case. The vote counting machines are properly accredited, and by extension, Cochise County's machines are accredited.
Okay. So as you mentioned, this is the second time that they have asked the feds to investigate these claims that are, you know, being denied by the body that does this. But they sent an identical letter basically to the Attorney General Pam Bondi. Did they get any response?
No, they never got a response. And it's unclear if they will this time either. Tulsi Gabbard's office, they didn't respond to my question on that. But Tom Crosby said that they, at this vote, he's supervisor there, that they still wanted to send this letter to Tulsi Gabbard because of her presence at the FBI's raid in Fulton County, Georgia, and because her responses to questions about why she was even at that raid in the first place made clear that she believes that she has authority over any investigations involving election security. So that was their thinking in sending this letter to her.
Right. So it sounds like these supervisors inciting what just happened with this federal raid in Fulton County for, you know, basically the records of what happened a few elections ago there. Do they see this as a national issue? They see the laws in place, not just here, but around the country, as potentially problematic heading into the 2026 midterms?
I think so. I think that that might be fair to say. I think that, like I said, when I talked with Antinori, he was very clear that they don't want to break the law necessarily, but they do seemingly want to change them in some way. They feel that the law has been tweaked and that they want to get it sort of back to baseline, I think is the way he put it to me. Mm-hmm.
So at the same time, you mentioned Supervisor Tom Crosby there, who's still fighting his prosecution from doing this 4 years ago. Where does his case stand?
He is still fighting, and his prosecution right now actually looks really uncertain. His trial has been pushed back a few times, and for a while it was just at the request of his attorneys for a variety of different medical issues. But most recently, it was actually scheduled for early April that he was going to go to trial, and then it got pushed back again because the Attorney General's office found that one of the lead investigators on that case had falsified time cards and a few other records. There was an internal investigation into this person. It does not look like any of those records were related to Crosby's case, but obviously his defense is doing their job. They are worried about this and they want to look into it. And so they're now proposing to postpone his trial to early 2027, partly because they want time to look into this investigator, but also because a lot of the key witnesses in this case are election officials. And so a lot of them will not be available, you know, once sort of the election season really gets into full swing here until the end of the year and into early next year. Peggy Judd is also out of the country right now. I believe she's on a mission. And so she's not due to be back until early next year.
So that also pushes it past the 2026 midterms, when we have the current Democratic Attorney General Chris Mayes up for re-election. The main opponent there in that race told you, you know, he would not pursue this prosecution as well.
He did. He did tell me that. And I think that all of this raises the question, right, of whether Crosby will stand trial for this at all. And that question really matters because this case has seemingly really chilled any efforts by other counties to try anything similar to what Cochise did in 2022. You know, obviously part of that last cycle was that Donald Trump won the presidency. So on the Republican side, there wasn't really a lot of reason to push this type of stuff. But even in the lead up to that election, I remember I was talking with county supervisors across the state, and a lot of them were telling me that they were taking what happened to Crosby as a cautionary tale. Mm-hmm. I think it's worth noting, like, some of them said that ruefully, but others were relieved. This has served as sort of a shield for them. So if Crosby were to not stand trial, I think it would be interesting to see who jumps at the opportunity to try something like this and who is able to sort of stand up to the pressure that's going to come down from people who have claimed that elections are stolen or that voting machines are compromised somehow.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's a lot to watch for sure, as we head into these midterm elections. Sasha Hupka is a reporter for VoteBeat here in Arizona. Sasha, thank you for coming on. Appreciate your reporting here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. The second season of the reality show Beast Games recently wrapped up on Amazon Prime, with the winner taking home $5 million. The program is hosted by Jimmy Donaldson, a.k.a. Mr. Beast, and the season featured a competition pitting strength against smarts.
You're witnessing the first time in human history the 100 strongest and the 100 smartest have ever been in the same room. Will it be brains or biceps that wins Beast Games? Because only one of the
My next guest was one of the contestants on the SMART team. Sammy Harker is a PhD student at ASU studying neuroscience. She graduated high school when she was 16 and then finished two undergraduate degrees at ASU 2 years later. Her research focuses on autism. She was diagnosed with it as a teenager. She describes Beast Games as a lot of different hardcore challenges and also social dynamics and how you approach problems. When I spoke with her earlier, I asked about some of those challenges.
I mean, I in a way, I kind of say like being on the show was a little bit of a challenge in itself. And I think like as a viewer, like in season one, I didn't really understand like what that meant. I've never been on a TV show before. And I felt like the challenge was just getting in that mindset. When we first got up on the stage, we just saw like these platforms and they're like kind of like square type platforms. And yeah, there was like a smaller little section that had this like stack of blocks on it with a little cover. And so Jimmy, the host, Mr. Beast, had asked us to take that off and then essentially like explain the challenge to us that we were going to be stacking blocks from memory. So that was like the SMART team's first challenge. And so like bare bones, the challenge was just stacking blocks from memory, which feels like it sounds pretty simple.
Yeah. It's,
for me personally, like I really like memory. And so I felt like that was something I was pretty good at. But for me, I really like numbers memory. And I feel like memorizing blocks just felt a little bit different because with this, there's also that like physical aspect involved of, as they were explaining the game to us, it's you have to like pick up blocks and stack them on a tiny little platform and like run across with as many blocks as possible at a time to do that. And so I think like also that added physical layer makes it more difficult and not just like a memory challenge, but also like strategy of how many blocks are you going to grab and like all those things. Yeah. And I don't know if you want me to go into more specifics of that challenge, but unfortunately the road kind of ends for me after that challenge.
Yeah. Well, it kind of sounds like it's like part quiz bowl, part feats of strength, part like morality play almost.
Yeah. Yeah. And I completely agree.
So you mentioned that you were part of the SMART team, and I want to ask you about that because you have accomplished an awful lot in your life in not that long a time. I mean, you're getting your PhD in neuroscience. You graduated from college at the age that a lot of students are starting college. How would you describe sort of your childhood and early adulthood up until now?
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of factors that went into that and a lot of like reasons for why I made the decisions that I did. But I'd say like in general, I grew up in kind of like an atypical environment. And a lot of the decisions I made was trying to like find something that I was passionate about and something that would kind of like help me cope and like get out of a negative situation. And, one of my parents, my mom, was like very supportive of that. When I was 16, I was able to graduate high school and switch over to going to college full time and ended up graduating very, very quickly from there. But I think like the biggest driver was definitely like trying to find something that could help me like get out of a negative situation. And then also in that time or around that time when I was going through that, I received an autism diagnosis. And I remember feeling like kind of lost because there wasn't a lot of research or resources for autistic people online, especially autistic women. And so that became one of my goals was that not only did I want to try to like pave my own path, but also develop some sort of resources or tools for people like me that felt like there wasn't a lot out there for them.
Once you were able to find more resources and information about autism, specifically in women, how did that feel for you? Like, did things start to kind of make sense? Did like, were you confused about this?
Yeah. I think there was a lot of confusion, and I think still nowadays like, there's still a lot of confusion. There's
sure.
Like that. That was actually why I wanted to go on this show. Is that if I did win the money, I was going to probably donate like almost all of it to research, especially like my current lab's research that I'm a part of. Because we focus a lot on like older autistic people, and that's a very small research population. And so I think like going through all of this, a lot of my confusion was just like, what does it mean to grow up autistic? And like, I feel like I don't resonate or relate to a lot of the representations that I'm seeing in the media. And I feel like I don't know very many other autistic people. And if I do, I feel like they're very like different than I am, and they don't represent like the same symptomology that I have. And I think like being a person in research, I've come to realize a lot of those differences are autism. Like that's just what it is, that no autistic person is the same, and every autistic person has their own array of difficulties and amazing features about them. And so there's all these different ways to think about autism, and you can kind of think of it like a color wheel. Like there's this weird like hex code combination that makes like one autistic person. And so I think that also added another layer of confusion for me of like, wow, are we really diagnosing all the autistic people out there? Like, are there all these people that don't know about their autistic identity, and they're just living life like not knowing and just maybe feeling like they're different, but not really understanding why? And so something that kind of cleared up that confusion, at least for me, was learning about like the lost generation, is that there are a lot of adults out there that don't actually know that they're autistic, and they maybe come to realize it way later. But then the other side of confusion for that is that, okay, if you finally do get an autism diagnosis in adulthood, like what does that mean for you? Like what can you do to get resources for that? Like what does that entail?
Is this kind of research something that you would like to continue doing even after you've gotten your PhD?
Yeah, I think it's definitely something I want to stay involved in. I think for me, like my biggest focus right now is I've become really interested in a field called genetic counseling. And I became really interested in that because through research, right now, a lot of the work that I do deals with making what's called like a genetic score for our participants. And so we take like a spit sample, a saliva sample from them, and we essentially like genotype that. And then I have somebody's like set of genetics that they're born with, and I can use publicly available data to make like one singular number that could represent their genetic risk or their genetic liability for a certain phenotype. So for example, like if somebody's interested in their risk for Alzheimer's disease, I could find a publicly available data set and generate a score that represents a number for somebody's risk for that. But the limitation as a researcher with that is that you're not necessarily allowed to give people guidance on that or like interpret that for them, because you don't have the like knowledge or education as to how to guide people to make informed decisions about that. And so like genetic counselors, they run even more complex tests than we do, and they can look at different genetic variants or markers for a whole array of different conditions, whether that's like in neurodevelopment or that's in cancer or that's like cardiovascular. And then they can help people make like guided and informed decisions based off of that instruction manual that they come with. And that's something that I'm really excited about moving into, especially because in the autism field, there's been a lot of like misdirection historically with genetics being used in kind of like an exclusionary context rather than helpful context. And so I want to be a person that can kind of help with that and make autistic people feel a little bit more comfortable about being vulnerable and giving us their genetic information to help them.
Sammy Harker is a PhD student at ASU and was a contestant on season 2 of Beast Games on Amazon Prime. And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at @kjzztheshow.